Welcome to Voices of the People here on uhururadio.com. I'm the facilitator of this discussion, Yabinga Zimbabwe, and we have on the line with us Chairman Omalia Sitela, the Chairman of the African People's Socialist Party, and Chairwoman Penny Hess, the Chairwoman of the African People's Solidarity Committee. To participate in it, to lead a discussion that we're going to be having here on the economic crisis of imperialism and growing developments in with the incoming president and his cabinet. first of all, glad to have y'all on, despite not being able to be in the studio today.
Uhura, comrade.
Uhura. I was thinking it would be good if we could begin, you know, just talking about the economic crisis. Penny, could you lay out, you know, the events that we've seen happening this week?
Uhuru. Well, it's great to be here. I want to say Uhuru, Nubinga, and also congratulations on the expansion of your family. And we are out in Oakland for some events, including a volunteer recognition event last night, sponsored by the African People's Solidarity Committee. And it was great to have the chairman there. It was a powerful event. And we're here in Oakland, and we have the chairman, and then we have an audience with Ona Ishitella, Bakari, Maureen, Comrade Maureen, and Comrade Wendy from African People's Solidarity Committee. So it's great to be here. And just to sum up what has been happening just in this past week, 533,000 jobs officially were lost in November. And this is very significant, and I want to read some things from the New York Times about it. This is the 11th month of a consistent monthly decline in employment, a decline in or a raising of unemployment. Unemployment rose to what the government says is 6.7%, but in reality, the rate is at least double that. It's at least 12.5% or more. This month's loss of jobs was the largest one-month loss since December 1974, and it shows that it promises to be the worst economic contraction since the Depression. It's on that trajectory now. I mean, of course, we know that, but this is the bourgeois media beginning to acknowledge this. In total, 1.9 million jobs have been lost in the last year, and by the end of this year, it will be 2 million jobs. And most of those have been in the last 3 months. I wanted to just read, just briefly, I mean, yesterday in the New York Times, after this came out, there were two articles in the Times. The first one was, U.S. loses 533,000 jobs in November. This was article number one, and this is some of what it was saying. It's quoting economists saying, quote, we have gone from recession into something that looks more like collapse, said Ian Shepherdson, chief domestic economist at High Frequency Economics, referring to the accelerating job losses in recent months. The losses in November far exceed the 350,000 figure that was consensus expectation of economists. Quote, business shut down in November, said Mark Zandi, chief economist at Moody'sEconomy.com. Businesses are in survival mode and are slashing jobs and investment to conserve cash. Unless credit starts flowing again soon, big job losses will continue into the next year. So you have the bourgeois economists just in complete freak out over the economic situation. Now, the New York Times also had another article yesterday on this same report, and the title of this was Grim Job Report Not Showing Full Picture. And this is an article that says, as bad as the headline numbers in Friday's unemployment report were, they still made the job market look better than it really is. The unemployment rate reached its highest point since 1993, and overall unemployment fell by more than 500,000 jobs. Yet that was just the beginning. Thanks to the vagaries of the way the government's best-known job statistics are calculated, they have overlooked many workers who have been deeply affected by the current recession. The number of people out of the labor force, meaning that they were neither working nor looking for work, and that the government did not consider them unemployed, jumped by 637,000 last month, the Labor Department said. See, this is the thing. The government does these fake labor reports, and it doesn't at all give the real picture of the unemployment that's out there. The quote, the article goes on to say, the number of part-time workers who said they wanted full-time work, all counted as fully employed, rose by an additional 621,000. So you're talking about 1,200,000 right there, if you double both of those numbers. And it said, take these people into account and the job market may be in its worst condition since the early 1980s, and it is still deteriorating rapidly, too. Already, the share of men older than 20 with jobs was at its lowest point since last month since 1983, and very close to the low point in the last 60 years. The share of women with jobs is lower than it was 8 years ago, which never happened in previous decades. The number of women employed has never gone down, ever. And then it just quotes these Wall Street economists whose analysis usually comes up shaded in rose, seem taken aback by the report. Goldman Sachs called the new numbers, quote, horrendous. Others said dreadful and almost indescribably terrible. In a note to clients, Morgan Stanley economist wrote, quite simply, there was nothing good in this report. HSBC Bank forecasters said they now expected the Federal Reserve to reduce its benchmark interest rates all the way to zero. Anyway, it goes on, and it's it shows, I mean, these guys are shocked. And just to say one other thing about that unemployment rate is that the unemployment statistic is what's called a lagging indicator. It's 6 to 12 months behind the actual economic conditions. So that means if suddenly the economy were fabulous tomorrow, it would still take a year before job losses stopped. So that's how dire it is. And I saw you, Chairman, did you want to make a comment on that?
Well, just to say that the government cooks the books in terms of the employment numbers. And another huge sector of the population that's not included in the as factors are the numbers of people who are in prison.
Yes.
Because they are not counted as a part of the job market either. So when they talk about unemployed or employed, these people are not a factor. And one thing that the government does in order to impact on the numbers is the lock of African people in prison. So the greater the number of African people in prison, then the greater the number of people who are not counted mm-hmm. as unemployed because right. they're not a part of the job market. This is one of the things that the Clinton administration was able to do. When we talk about the success of the economic success of the Clinton administration, part of what we're talking about is the numbers of people who were no longer counted as unemployed because they were stuffed into prisons. The other thing I would say about this cooking of the books around the employment issue is how the government plays a role in deceiving the so-called investors and the stock market about the state of the economy. Because when they cook the books and falsify the number of people who are really unemployed, then there's an assumption that producers or people who are dealing with the economy make determinations based on what is assumed to be the buying power of the public at large. And that's based on what they would assumed to be employed and unemployed people. But of course, if in fact the books are cooked and they have used these shaded methods of determining the number of people who are actually not working, then you cannot successfully make a determination of in any way, you know, like with the economy. So people make their investments as they characterize it, or they mess with the stock market, based on the assumption that a company or corporation has the ability to do this or that because there's a certain number of people who are employed and have income and therefore would be able to function as consumers when in fact they're in prison and the books have been cooked and they have just not been counted. So I just think that it is just further evidence of how the entire thing is rigged. And beyond that, this whole notion of capitalism being the economic savior of all of humanity should be something that's becoming increasingly obvious as untrue. And I know that one of the reasons they have been able to say that is because of what they have perceived to be the significance of the implosion or the collapse of the Soviet Union and the Chinese model, if you will. But the fact is, even if they were correct in assuming that socialism existed in the former Soviet Union and existed in China, even if they were correct in saying that, what they hide is the fact that the capitalist system is a world economy. It's not an American economy. It's not a European or French economy. It's a world economy. And that when you look at the poverty of African people in places like Congo, Sierra Leone, Nigeria, Kenya, or any other place, or Harlem, if for that matter, you are looking at capitalism at work. Capitalism, by its very nature, of course, is an economic system that requires the blood sucking of somebody for the success of the minority who owns and controls everything that's necessary to produce a real life. So those are just some observations I would make. Uhura.
Uhura, and yes, I mean, I think that that's really important to bring out. And in fact, we can't understand it without understanding African internationalism and the chairman's theory of parasitic capitalism. It's come as far as it could go. There's no place else to go. It's sucked the blood dry. They're fighting over what's left of the resources. And when you think about, Chairman, that we have a situation where the U.S. economy was based 72% overall of the gross domestic product based on consumerism.
Exactly.
And in the state of California, it's 81%. And California has the second largest economy, I think, in the U.S. and the fourth in the world or something
like
that.
And the second largest prison population
exactly.
in the world.
Yes.
So the fact is all those people in prison actually disguise
yes.
the extent of the economic crisis.
Right.
And so the capitalists delude themselves in terms of how good the economy is and what the power of the consumer is. When all these people who should be involved in the economic system who should be consumers are actually in prison, but they are not factored into the equations that's being used to make a determination about the state of the economy.
Yes, and not only are they disguised in that way, but also prisons have been a key economic stimulus for the white population
exactly.
and for Wall Street
yes.
for the last, in particular, since the counterinsurgency, the defeat of the Black Revolution in the 60s. And that it's the one thing that they're counting on to keep going, that and the illegal drug economy. Just to say a few other things about... Go ahead.
No, I just think that's important. The point that you're making, of course, is shows how, you know, the contradictions of capitalism itself. The prison as an institution in this country... can generate capital by locking up the consumers who make up the primary entity contributing to the actual economy itself. So it's this built-in contradiction. That's what capitalism is. You know, even creating the instruments of its own destruction by functioning normally and naturally and locking up all these people in prison is a normal function of capitalism. It's one of the ways that it creates value on the one hand, but it does that at the expense of the critical element for its ongoing existence in this country in terms of people who would be consumers.
Uhuru, Chairman, I think that is a really important point, and it seems like also, in addition to that, that relationship of Africans being locked up in prison in this way proves that there is colonialism in the U.S. Yeah. Because that is, colonialism is used as economic stimulus, as growth, as the theft of resources yeah. and labor. To that's what the crisis is right now. It's the crisis of the resources. And, you know, I just think that's, if anybody wants to deny it, they're just blatantly denying something that's obviously true. There is colonialism, and that's what the prison population is.
May I just comment, some of the classical Marxists refer to the current crisis as being one of overproduction. It speaks to what is recognized as the anarchy of production capitalist system, where production is not done for use, really, but it's done for profit. So everything that's produced is a commodity because the basis of its production is not necessarily because people need such a thing, but because it can be sold, it can be traded, it can make money. And here you have, you know, that being, you know, like, you know, one of the interesting things. And then on the other hand, when you talk about a market being saturated, when you talk about overproduction, you talk about production that has occurred to the extent that everybody who has everybody who can afford a commodity has a commodity, and all the other production is redundant. And it takes the system like into a state of crisis because they have produced more. The anarchy has meant that they're just producing to sell it, and that doesn't take into account how many people can afford it, et cetera, produce it, try to seduce people into buying my product, buying my car as opposed to the other car, buying my boat as opposed to the other boat. So you have this overproduction. Everybody who's got a thing, who can afford it, has it. And now all this other production is a crisis because it can't be moved. And so that's many people define what they see now happening. Oh, I have seen some of the classical Marxists characterize that as overproduction. But what they miss is the fact that the reason they can talk about overproduction is because of the billions, more than billions, hundreds of millions of people who cannot participate in the economy in a meaningful way because of colonialism or imperialism. The more than a billion people, or half the world's population, who are living off less than $2 a day. So that the market, that what would be a market for the capitalist system is being destroyed. And so if they want to talk about overproduction, they mean that the person who is coming out and working in the mines in Sierra Leone, only making 30 cents a day, cannot afford to purchase what the capitalists are producing in terms of commodities. Can't even afford to purchase the diamonds or anything else that's coming out of Sierra Leone. And this is part of the contradiction of the capitalist system. They can call it overproduction if they want to, but the reality, it is a part of the parasitism that we've talked about in terms of most of the world, Africa, much of Asia, certainly Latin America, etc., being that pedestal upon which the entire thing rests. It is the irony here is that a parasite usually has to attempt to keep its host alive. Otherwise, the parasite itself would die. If the host dies, then the parasite has nothing to live on. And that's how the whole system of imperialism works. It cuts out a critical sector of the population as people who could participate in a meaningful way in terms of as a market. For the very things that's being produced. And that, if you want to, you can call it overproduction.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's coherent or not.
I think it's really important, and I hope that, you know, this kind of theoretical analysis of it can really be summed up a lot. I think that it's really key because nobody that's looking at this, and some people understand the short-term, you know, reasons why some of this crisis is happening, but nobody understands what you're talking about, Chairman. None of these economists that, you know, the question is the resources, the question is the colonial question that's happening and playing out right now. just to, I'm hoping that we're going to get a chance to really sum up Obama's economic plan, and that was announced yesterday, or he had a radio thing on it yesterday. And just to say really quickly a few other quick statistics, that now 31 million people in the U.S. are on food stamps, and that's 10% of the population. That's pretty serious. Also, in November, the second highest use of credit card nationally was for food, for going, I think specifically McDonald's was the second highest thing being charged on credit cards, and that's really a serious indicator.
Or it should be healthcare if they're going to McDonald's.
It's true, but, you know.
Maybe that'll be the following month.
The indicator, anyway. And that foreclosures, there are up to 2 million foreclosures in the so-called prime sector, the people with fixed rate, not subprime. And in addition to subprime foreclosures, that it's 1 in 10 of all homeowners are in default or in foreclosure. That's an enormous amount. And that the United Nations economists predict, quote, a hard landing of the dollar in 2009. And that means that basically the dollar is in what they call a rally right now. The dollar is relatively high, and only because investors around the world are seeking what they call safe haven, because the financial stocks of Wall Street are crashing, so they're putting their money in the dollar. But China came out with an interesting statement for the first time, because China owns like something like 1.4 trillion U.S. dollars. But China said officially, quote, they will not save the U.S. economy by continuing to invest in the dollar. And right now, Liu Jiwei, chairman and chief executive of the China Investment Corporation in China, said that China had, quote, no intention of saving the West from the financial crisis. He said, right now, we do not have the courage to invest in financial institutions because we do not know what problems they may have.
Right.
So that is a powerful statement. And also understanding that China, from what we're reading, is near civil war, because the struggles are so intense. And at least 1.5 million workers have been laid off just in the toy industry. The U.S., you know, can't buy these things anymore. So those are just some of the things. There's a lot more to say, but every week it's becomes more and more dire.
I want to at this point, I want to open it up for our listeners to be able to participate in the discussion that we're having here. You can do so by calling in to one of our numbers or emailing us. The U.S. number is 727-565-1599, and that's country code 001. The UK number is 020-8133-6629, and that's country code 44. You can call us through Skype. Our Skype ID is Uhuru Radio, and that's all one word, all lowercase. Or you can email us at dj@uhururadio.com. I also want to raise a question. There is a...
He's asking questions.
I'm getting a little bit of feedback over there.
Okay, he's getting feedback.
Okay. Yeah.
But there's there is a factory in Chicago that over this past week the workers occupied. Is a factory that has a relationship with Bank of America in terms of you know, lending and whatnot. And apparently the workers on Friday occupied the factory, refusing to leave it, you know, demanding they be paid severance pay and vacation pay that they're owed because the factory was closing. Now, is this something, this type of activity, something that we can anticipate more of, Penny and Chairman?
Chairman, did you want to say something to that?
Well, first of all, I think that I think we're looking at some of the better responses to the crisis when we see the, like, the factory takeover by workers in Chicago. And, of course, there are houses that are being in foreclosure that's being occupied by people in Miami, Florida. This is a consequence of organized activity, and I think that I think that we are going to see this kind of activity more and more And I'm glad to see that this is happening relatively early in the exposure of this economic crisis, because it will, I think, encourage other workers to take on similar kind of actions as opposed to laying dead. And I think that it is also foreboding for the regime of Barack Obama, who the imperialists assumed would be able to calm the situation down here and around the world through being the president of the Negro president of change. So I think we're going to see more of that. And I think we are also going to see other expressions of resistance that get even more serious and more difficult, not only for the capitalists, but perhaps for our own communities, if we don't get organized and channel resistance into the kinds of things that are being done by the factory workers there, and to create the consciousness, a consciousness that revolution is going to be necessary to overturn this whole system.
Now, Penny mentioned the fact that that Obama announced a supposedly massive economic stimulus plan. I want to play a quick bit of this announcement and see if we can discuss that. So this is Barack Obama on the economic stimulus plan.
Good morning. Yesterday, we received another painful reminder of the serious economic challenge our country is facing when we learned that 533,000 jobs were lost in November alone, the single worst month of job loss in over three decades. That puts the total number of jobs lost in this recession at nearly 2 million. But this isn't just about numbers. It's about each of the families those numbers represent. It's about the rising unease and frustration that so many of you are feeling during this holiday season. Will you be able to put your kids through college? Will you be able to afford health care? Will you be able to retire with dignity and security? Will your job or your husband's job or your daughter's or son's jobs be the next one's cut? These are the questions that keep so many Americans awake at night. It's not the first time these questions have been asked, though. We faced difficult times before, times when our economic destiny seemed to be slipping out of our hands. And at each moment, we have risen to meet the challenge as one people, united by a sense of common purpose. And I know that Americans can rise to the moment once again. But we need action, and action now. That's why I've asked my economic team to develop an economic recovery plan for both Wall Street and Main Street that will help save or create at least 2.5 million jobs while rebuilding our infrastructure, improving our schools, reducing our dependence on oil, and saving billions of dollars. We won't do it the old Washington way. We won't just throw money at the problem. We'll measure progress by the reforms we make and the results we achieve, by the jobs we create, by the energy we save, by whether America is more competitive in the world. Today, I'm announcing a few key parts of my plan. First, we will launch a massive effort to make public buildings more energy efficient. Our government now pays the highest energy bills in the world. We need to change that. We need to upgrade our federal buildings by replacing old heating systems and installing efficient light bulbs. That won't just save you, the American taxpayer, billions of dollars each year. It will put people back to work. Second, we will create millions of jobs by making the single largest new investment in our national infrastructure since the creation of the federal highway system in the 1950s. We'll invest your precious tax dollars in new and smarter ways, and we'll set a simple rule: use it or lose it. If a state doesn't act quickly to invest in roads and bridges in their communities, they'll lose the money. Third, my economic recovery plan will launch the most sweeping effort to modernize and upgrade school buildings that this country has ever seen. We will repair broken schools, make them energy efficient, and put new computers in our classrooms. because to help our children compete in a 21st century economy, we need to send them to 21st century schools. As we renew our schools and highways, we'll also renew our information superhighway. It is unacceptable that the United States ranks 15th in the world in broadband adoption. Here in the country that invented the internet, every child should have the chance to get online. And they'll get that chance when I'm president, because that's how we'll strengthen America's competitiveness in the world. In addition to connecting our libraries and schools to the internet, we must also ensure that our hospitals are...
That was Barack Obama on his supposedly massive economic stimulus plan. We're going to take a break here and come back and discuss this plan and whether this is something that's going to save imperialism. So stay tuned here on Voices of the People on WhoRadio.com.
Then fit to put them 2 years.
Never put them 5 years.
Then fit to put them 7 years.
Never put them 10 years.
Then fit to put them 6 months.
Never put them 1 year.
Then fit to put them 2 years.
Never put them 5 years.
Then fit to put them 7 years.
Never put them 10 years.
If not, them go shoot them well. Them go shoot them for I'm wrong. Workers, labor workers, 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 them go they try to try to make ends meet. Them go they hustle to try to make ends meet. Them go put hands for back to try to make ends meet. Them go they beg your guy to try to make ends meet. Them go be slaves for them town to try to make ends meet. Yes, them go they try to try to make ends meet. Them go they hustle to try to make ends meet. I say turn your face small to the right wing. Oh God, bata bata day for the authority people day for the instead of workers. Instead of buses, them they ride motor car. Instead of motorcycle, now helicopter. Instead of them worker, now worker go worker for them. Authority people, them go they steal. Public contribute plenty money. Now authority people they steal. Authority man not the big pocket. Now petty cash him go they pick. I'm robber him need gun. Authority man, him need pen. Authority man in charge of money. Him no need gun, him need pen. Pen get power, gonna get. If gun steal 80,000 naira, pen go steal a billion
naira. And welcome back to WhoRadio.com. This is Voices of the People. And we just listened to the... President-elect of U.S. imperialism, Barack Obama, say, you know, that he's got this plan, a stimulus plan, to solve the economic problem, contradiction in the U.S. Penny, is this plan going to work?
Uhuru, no, it is not. And that's not to say that it might not be a Band-Aid for a little while, but it is not going to save the U.S. economy. It's not going to save capitalism, and here are some reasons why. First of all, what Obama said, among what he said, and he hasn't said how much of this is going to cost or where the money's going to come from, that they're going to create 2.5 million jobs, make public buildings more energy efficient, something about putting light bulbs in them, repair schools, modernize healthcare. He's talking about with electronic record keeping, which has nothing to do with people's health care. It just has to do with, as the chairman is summing up, feeding the internet moguls. And he's talking about building infrastructures, highways, bridges, etc. And people are comparing, especially in the white left, are comparing his plan, and I think he is too, to Franklin Roosevelt's plan during the 1930s after the Great Depression. And during that time, Roosevelt and the bourgeoisie, in an attempt to save itself from the crisis of imperialism that was called the Great Depression, instituted things like food stamps for the first time, like Social Security, programs like this, building infrastructure called the Work Progress Administration, things like that, that got jobs and rescued the situation. So I want to say some things about why Obama's plan will not work in the long term, or maybe probably not even in the short term. And that here's five things about it. First of all, if Obama, even as a capitalist, trying to save capitalists, were serious about saving capitalism or Wall Street, he would do what European countries or other countries have had to do in this similar kind of situation. He would bring to trial the bankers who looted the Wall Street, who looted this based on the subprime mortgage scam, where they were reinvesting that. He would open up the books, which he has not forced the Wall Street bankers to open up the books. So like China is saying, it's not going to invest because it doesn't, all these bad loans are secret. And but also that Obama's economic team are the same people that were involved in creating this crisis. Geithner, however you say it, the new Secretary of the Treasury, was the head of the Federal Reserve of the New York Federal Reserve Bank while all this was happening, while all of this looting was going on by these bankers. He did nothing about it. He facilitated it with his policies, with the low interest rates and everything else. Robert Rubin was another one of Obama's team, was Clinton's Secretary of the Treasury, who fought for the repeal of the Glass-Steagall Act, which had all of the Roosevelt-era restrictions on what Wall Street can do, which prevented it from doing the kind of blatant looting that it did in this past period. He called for he fought for the repeal of that act under Clinton, and as soon as it passed, he quit the Secretary of the Treasury and joined Goldman Sachs or Morgan Stanley, and has made, as a CEO of that, $150 million over the last few years because of that. Lawrence Summers, the same thing, another one of the key team. So this is number one. Number two, Obama keeps talking about in his, when he's talking about his economic stimulus plan, he's talking about, quote, the middle class. First of all, and everybody knows the middle class means white. It means white. He is not addressing the economic conditions or the foreclosures, the job losses that African people have already had. And I think it's really important to point out also that in studying Roosevelt's plan in the 1930s, that everything that Roosevelt did either excluded African people or hurt the African population. For example, Social Security, when it was created in 1935, people have to understand that was only for white people. Every job that African people had, basically, was not included in Social Security. That means that excluded from Social Security was agriculture, domestic service, teachers, and nurses. They did not get it. So that meant that Social Security excluded 75% of all the jobs that African people had in the United States and 50% of the entire U.S. labor force. So it helped white people, and it helped the upper class. It helped the white middle class. Food stamps and AFDC was created, but it was left up under Roosevelt, but it was left up to states' rights. And it was given out, especially in the southern states, to white people. It was much harder for Africans to get food stamps. The minimum wage was instituted under Roosevelt. But the institution of it caused an enormous amount of unemployment for African people because the white employers were not going to give Africans minimum wage. They just, you know, they were laid off. White farmers under Roosevelt were paid not to plant. So that meant the huge population of African sharecroppers were pushed off the land. So everything basically that happened at that time under Roosevelt was at the expense of Africans. And that's not going to happen. I mean, African people are not going to accept that this time. And, you know, he's not going to be able to do that. And just to say the cost of trying to deal with a true economic stimulus for the entire population of the U.S. would be virtually impossible to do. Number three, Obama's plan before, okay, when Roosevelt was doing this in the 1930s, there was no $11 trillion debt, or when you add Social Security and everything, $55 trillion debt that the U.S. had. It didn't have a debt like that. The U.S. had no trade deficit at that time. The U.S. was the exporter and creditor nation. Now the U.S. is the importer and debtor nation. The dollar was on the gold standard then. There were none of these derivatives based on mortgages that were highly leveraged, which means they had no money down. They just kept reinvesting in what's called a Ponzi scheme. That didn't happen in the 1930s. And the U.S. had factories it was producing. So the conditions economically, and the world economy now is based on capitalism, is deeply in the state of collapse. And that was not the situation then. In the 1930s, you were talking about a consolidation of elements of the U.S. ruling class. And it's completely different. Number four, as the chairman has pointed out over and over again, what really ended the economic crisis of the 1930s was the Second Imperialist War, which left the U.S. as the head of U.S. world imperialism. It took over the colonial wealth that Britain was exploiting out of the majority of the world, especially in Africa. It took over the resources, the oil, the diamonds, the uranium, the bauxite of the colonial peoples all over the world, so that you had this enormous resources flowing into the U.S. that created an economic boom after the Second Imperialist War. That's what got the U.S. out of the Depression. And five, Obama says, he keeps you saying that, you know, he's going to do this to jumpstart capitalism again, to jumpstart the economy, to get it going. But that is so, that is completely ridiculous. That is completely unscientific. If you look at capitalism is born on the exploitation of resources and labor of African people and people around the world. It can only work through constant growth, quote unquote. And growth means expansion of colonialism, expansion of exploitation of people around the world. And that's over. There's no more bubbles to be had. I mean, there's, you know, it's over. The for one thing, peoples around the world are taking control of their own resources, are fighting for it, destabilizing the ability of the U.S. to even do that. And secondly, the resources themselves are in peril because they're running out of them. I mean, Yemen is out of oil. It was on a sea of oil. Dubai, these countries are going bankrupt because they are running out of oil. And the U.S. has just plundered everything. And when you have a situation where parasitism has come to the level where inside the U.S. it didn't even produce anything, but the economy was generated by 75% gross domestic product, and something like 80% of that 75% was on credit, not even money that people had. What I mean, you know, people are in debt up to their necks. They have hundreds of thousands of dollars of debt in a typical, you know, middle income family. And there's no way to jump start that. It can't happen. It's over. It's over. Imperialism is over. They can keep doing band-aids, cover up the statistics, try to do this and that. I mean, what Obama's talking about is going to cost another several trillion dollars. And China's saying, and that only happened, that happens because the U.S. prints the money. But again, that is a loan. That is a, they're taking a loan out to do that. And China's saying, we're not doing it. The Arab countries are bankrupt. Oil's down to $40 a barrel. And Saudi Arabia is saying it needs $95 a barrel just to meet its expenses. It's bankrupt. It was a big investor in the U.S. economy. It can't do that. Who's going to pay for it? So it's, you know, it's crazy. It's not going to happen. And that's why they're sending another 20,000 U.S. troops in, because they know, quote, civil unrest. There's going to be rebellion. There's going to be struggle in this country coming up as this crisis deepens.
Chairman, as you've exposed through the theory of African internationalism, you know, this system lives off the back of oppressed peoples, and while Obama's plan, as he explained it, didn't include deepening the parasitic relationship with other peoples around the world, we do see indications of things like AFRICOM and whatnot with the intention to do that. How do we stop the U.S. from being able to solve its crisis at the expense of Africans and other people?
Well, AFRICOM is just one expression of the U.S. Intervention in Africa. Of course, you know, everything that we see happening in Congo today, where there's an escalation of violence and brutality and people being murdered, is a part of the contest that the United States is making. And there are other expressions of that throughout Africa, Somalia, Ivory Coast, and various other places. So that needs to be clear. Secondly, I think in response to your question, what we have to understand is that we are not looking at some domestic situation in this country, either a situation that's peculiar to our neighborhood in some city or state or the United States itself, that we are looking at a truly international situation. And the fact is that increasingly, and even the election of Obama, selection of Obama for election, is evidence of how the imperialists themselves recognize that increasingly success depends on muting or confusing or undermining the ability of oppressed peoples and Africans around the world to deal with this imperialist crisis. So we believe that revolution is the only solution. And we understand that it's an international question. That's why we're building the African Socialist International. That's why in October we were just involved in a West African regional conference to build the African Socialist International. That's why there's one that's being planned for March in East Africa and Kenya. Why there in June, I think, is Southern Africa. One is being planned where we are working, even as this discussion is occurring, we're meeting with Africans in Central America to build regional African Socialist International component there, and why in May a North American regional conference is going to be held. The thing is that we got to have a revolutionary organization that can fight on every front that recognizes that it is not some local situation that we're confronted with, but an international crisis, and we have to have an international organization with a single center that can give our struggle everywhere in Sierra Leone, Nigeria, or Harlem, for that matter, a strategic capacity. Revolution is the only solution. Overturning capitalism, especially as it in its growing, weakening state, is essential to the future of humanity, and certainly it is essential to the liberation of Africa and African people.
Well, that's all the time we have for today for Voices of the People. But stay tuned, because there's more coming up on uhururadio.com. And even if you want to participate in this discussion again, we're going to be doing it again on next week here on uhururadio.com. So tune in every Sunday live at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time. Uhuru.
Work, comrade.
Africa Live. Saying is, ain't nobody gonna do this for us but us. Talk about a Barack Obama. Don't even talk to me about Barack Obama. Let's talk about Marcus Garvey. You know what I'm saying? The question ain't whether we vote for white power and white face or white power and black face. The question is whether we will be an independent people or whether we remain colonized and oppressed until we are wiped out. This is African internationalism in action, y'all. Y'all need to get up on this. When we say we have to have power in our own hands, here we're talking about the African working class. What we can do is to have an organized capacity of the African workers in alliance with the poor peasants who takes state power for itself. Then we can begin to say we got justice in our own hands.
Africa Live.
Raise up these incredible African leaders that we've had. It's critical that as African people we strive to be like them. I'm talking about the Marcus Garveys. I'm talking about the Fannie Lou Hamers. I'm talking about the Malcolm X's, the Kwame Nkrumahs, and today we have Omali Eshetela.
Brothers and sisters, Africans at home and abroad, welcome to Africa Live.
Uhuru, and welcome to Africa Live here on uhururadio.com. I'm your host, Yabinga Zimbabwe, and I want to talk a bit today about an incredible leader who's cut down as a young man. 39 years ago, on December 1969, the chairman of the Illinois chapter of the Black Panther Party was murdered by the state, was assassinated by the U.S. government. His name was Fred Hampton. He was a 21-year-old man who at this young age had become an incredible leader, an incredible force in the Black Power movement of the 60s. He was someone who was, you know, just a great leader who was responsible for you know, operating the various programs of the Black Panther Party based in Illinois. Someone who the U.S. government saw the need to assassinate, saw the need to get rid of because of the potential that he had as a leader, even in this period of these deep attacks against the African community, particularly against the Black Power movement. He was a force who they had to get rid of. I want to talk about this kind of in context, because, you know, we're going to be hearing later today in the broadcast discussion, particularly on the Who Are on the Move, about the cases of like Ajimu Bandele and Mumia Abu-Jamal, who were both political prisoners attacked by the U.S. government because of their work in fighting to overturn the parasitic oppression and exploitation that the U.S. holds Africans in. And I think that when we talk about, you know, when we look at these cases, when we look at the cases of Ajimu Bandele, when we look at the case of the Liberty City 7, when we look at the case of Troy Davis, of the Huntsville 3, of Mumia Abu-Jamal, the case of the San Francisco 8, and various other cases of Africans who find themselves on trial and are locked up unjustly, you know, there's a way that people can see, you know, way that people can be confused, you know, because, you know, there has been a serious propaganda campaign that the U.S. government has waged, not just in the U.S., but around the world, to criminalize African people, and to criminalize the African community. You know, I mean, that was when we look at the 60s, you know, when we look at the period of just like intense resistance, you know, in this country, in the U.S., the country I'm talking about at the moment. But not just here, in other places around the world, African people are struggling for freedom. During that period, it was known around the world that African people in the U.S., were victims of the U.S. government. It was clear to people around the world that African people in the U.S. were a population that was held under terror, a population that, you know, that was being attacked in a serious kind of way. You know, people knew about the things like dogs being sicked on people and things of this sort. You know, it was clear during that period, you know, Africans being shot down, killed, just as we are today. It was clear in that period, though, around the world that African people were victims of U.S. Of the U.S. Government. With the whole Jim Crow apartheid situation, that form of colonial domination here. But what has happened is, since that period, the U.S. government has waged a serious kind of propaganda campaign. First of all, it destroyed the Black Power movement. It destroyed the Black Power movement, and part of how they did that was they assassinated leaders. Through the FBI's counterintelligence program, just assassinated leaders and locked leaders up, locked up members of organizations like the Black Panther Party, killed members of such organizations as the Black Panther Party, as Jomo, the Junta of Militant Organization, and and various other organizations. You know, the Black Power movement was under serious kind of assault. We saw this assault happening, not just against the Africans, but saw what was happening against indigenous peoples here. The thing is, we saw it was clear. Like I said, it was clear in that period that Africans were victims. But what happened is, following the defeat, the military defeat of the Black Power movement, and we specifically say the military defeat because the fact is that, you know, ideologically, the Black Power movement had won. The Black Power movement had captured the imaginations of African people in the U.S., not just in the U.S., but other places around the world. The Black Power movement was able to expose this relationship with white power, so ideologically, you know, the Black Power movement had won. And politically, the Black Power movement had won. The thing is, they militarily defeated our movement. Waged, you know, kind of warfare, like I said, assassinating leaders, locking our leaders up, and then at the point where the organizations were destroyed of the Black Power movement, the U.S. government turned its counterinsurgent programs against the general African population. And so we saw, you know, biological warfare, chemical warfare, in the form of the illegal drug economy that the U.S. government created, bringing crack into the African community, to salt the earth, to destroy people's ability to organize, even after having crushed these organizations, had, you know, really, you know, salted the earth, you know, by putting drugs in the community so people can't even think about getting organized because they're too busy thinking about getting the next hit of them drugs, you know. And we saw, you know, it really demoralized the African community. But what they also did at the same time, the U.S. government raised up neo-colonialism. Raised up faces of people who look like us, you know, but work against the interest of African people. So you begin to see people become mayors hold positions in Congress and whatnot, You see these individual Negroes have the ability to advance, but it advance at the expense of the rest of us to gather wealth and resources for themselves, but at the expense of the rest of us, you know. So we saw that in the period after that, and the U.S. government used that. They throw up Michael Jordan or Oprah Winfrey and tell Africans in the U.S. and outside of the U.S., see, look how good we treat the Negroes now. Look how good we treat them, you know. There's all this opportunity, you know, for them now, you know. But the problem is that they're criminals. So you saw, you know, the drug economy. Used in two different ways to attack our community. One, to keep us from being able to organize by having our people, hooked on these terrible drugs that the U.S. government brought in, but also then using the illegal drug economy, the U.S. government imposed illegal drug economy as an excuse to attack the African community, as an excuse to say, look, here, you know, these guys are criminals. This is a criminal community. And so they come in with, you know, with, police containment. They come in to attack the community and lock up African people like crazy. And so we saw, the situation where people become confused about the situation of African people in this country, but the reality is that nothing has changed. The reality is that Africans are still victims of U.S. imperialism, that Africans in the U.S., just like in the 1960s and before that, are a colonized population inside the U.S. and are people who need power, over our own lives. Are people who have no power at this point, despite the fact that you have a president who might look like us. We are a powerless population, and a population that has to get organized to change our situation. We see the government, the U.S. government, waging these types of attacks, same kind of attacks that they waged in the 1960s, to kill, our leaders, to lock up our leaders, to lock up, African people, and definitely to prevent African people from being able to organize in our own interest, This is what it did in the 1960s. It's what it's doing now. And so we look back at forces like Fred Hampton, who, like I said, was the chairman of the Illinois chapter of the Black Panther Party, and a great leader, who the government killed in a ridiculous kind of fashion, who 4 o'clock in the morning, the U.S. government busted into the house where Fred Hampton was sleeping, after having already had an agent, FBI agent provocateur, to put to drug Fred Hampton, putting drugs in his Kool-Aid to make him incapable of being able to respond at all, to make him completely helpless. And then they bust in at 4 o'clock in the morning on December 4th, 1969, and murder Fred Hampton in his bed. Shoot him dead in his bed. 21-year-old Fred Hampton. This is the U.S. government. This is the state. I think it's important for us to look at the example of Fred Hampton, to look at to look back at at what happened in the 1960s with forces like Fred Hampton, so we can understand and look at the U.S. war of counterinsurgency, so we can understand how we have to move, how we have to get organized for power over our own lives, so that we can stop these things from being able to happen, so we can stop the U.S. government from being able to attack our people, to attack our leaders. We have to get organized to change that situation. I want to, we're going to take a break here, and we'll come back. We're going to open it up for people to be able to participate in this discussion. The phone numbers here are, you can call the U.S. number, which is 727-565-1599. That's country code 001. You can call the U.K. number, which is 020-8133-6629, and that's country code 44. You can call us through Skype anywhere in the African world for free. Our Skype ID is Uhuru Radio, and that's all one word, all lowercase. Or you can email us at dj@uhururadio.com. Stay tuned. We'll be right back here on Africa Live on the WhoRadio.com.
Yeah. Check this out. One time for your mind.
Japanese
things. Get away from the man.
Check it out.
From gorillas to gangsters, projects to pyramids. The U.S. government is conducting experiments. The terror commenced for slavery like Maryland's, when we was taken from Africa, called Americans. We worked all day and slept in the slave quarters. I used to be the overseer, now the Jake's on us. We still living slaves, trapped in the same borders. Only difference now, we go to work with 8 quarters on the train, telling ourselves to maintain on our way to misery, coming home to the same bullshit. The pigs walk the block with 4 clips, trying to send us to the place preachers talk about a pulpit. Who you with someone set you playing? Don't be from the ball hood that can get you bang on the rail. That shit got many brothers blasted. It got caught on the wrong side of Mother Gaston. The state gave us crack to make the people struggle backwards, to make sure war against the state was unimagined. Part of the war they was making on the masses, to make sure the black population stayed trapped in
the state by the state. The state carry weight in and out of state. A fam take it day by the day. That's how it is when you trapped by the states. Trapped in the states by the state. My combat got snatched by the jakes. Africans take it day by the day. That's how it is when you trapped by the state.
On the border of Guinea and Sierra Leone, your colonial soldiers is heavily armed to keep the masses of the Africans separate from our resources getting ripped off by these imperialist hogs. It's so hot and truly good for till we control the fruits of our soil. We in pursuit of our gold, we end up traveling to North America in pursuit of resources that we were severed from. But if you're looking for a better life, forget it done. You came to the terror dome when niggas getting hung. Matter of fact, we would leave if we had consciousness, but the white ruling class control the politics. They're telling us to integrate into the populace and be a good house nigga like Obama is. But the fact is, Africans is held captive. From a land we was fractured.
Trapped in the state by the state. The state carry weight in and out of state. Our fam take it day by the day. That's how it is when you trapped by the states. Trapped in the states by the state. My combat got snatched by the jakes. Africans take it day by the day. That's how it is when you trapped by the state.
We had war with house niggas and police, winters with no heat, junk food and corner stores, levers with no teeth. Don't fuck with no beef. Tapeworms will take what you earn, even looking like you don't eat. With all the bullshit going on in my community, it make me wonder what more these crackers could try to do to me. Anything that you could think of, they throw me. From the slum lords to the local fiends, we don't sleep. The shots ring out regularly in the middle of the night. Clap back or don't eat. It's that simple, it's not a riddle. The only issue, who to put these slugs into, who responsible for the bullshit we going through. We say the state got us trapped in this misery, living in the ghetto. Some say we in prison in the mental. I disagree, we held hostages militarily.
Trapped in the state by the state. The state carry weight in and out of state. Our fam take it day by the day. That's how it is when you trapped by the states. Trapped in the states by the state. My combat got snatched by the jets. Africans take it day by the day. That's how it is when you trapped by the states.
Woo, and welcome back to Africa Live here on the WhoRadio.com. Like I said, we want to we've been talking about the leader Fred Hampton and his significance. Someone who was murdered. He was the leader of the chairman of he was the chairman of the Illinois chapter of the Black Panther Party, and was murdered assassinated by the U.S. government on December 4th, 1969. We're talking about Fred Hampton and his significance, and looking at it in the context of today, and the continuing attacks on African organizers, African leaders who who organize for Black Power. I just want to say, first of all, open it up to discussion for those of you out there to participate in it. You can participate in this discussion by calling the U.S. number, which is 727-565-1599, and that's country code 001. You can call the U.K. number, which is 020-8133-6629, and that's country code 44. You can call us through Skype anywhere in the African world for free. Our Skype ID is Uhuru Radio, and that's all one word, all lowercase. or you can email us at dj@uhururadio.com. Now, Fred Hampton, like I said, was an incredible leader. You know, at the age of 21, was the chairman of the Illinois chapter of the Black Panther Party. And he, like I said, was responsible for having led, you know, some of the programs that the Black Panther Party ran, including the free breakfast for school children program, including the healthcare program of the Black Panther Party. And you know, this type of work was a real challenge for imperialism, for U.S. imperialism, for the state. You know, because you know, it could not have African people doing for themselves. And you know, people talk about different things they think are significant about Fred Hampton, but I think that is one of the most important things that that Fred Hampton did was those programs. That was some of the most important work that that the Black Panther Party did. Those programs, and like I said, Hampton was an incredible leader. He was a courageous leader, and they the U.S. government killed him. It was the FBI working with the Chicago police who killed him. As I said, they killed him and Mark Clark, another member of the Illinois chapter of the Black Panther Party, on December 4th, 1969, at 4 o'clock in the morning, bursting into the house and shooting these brothers down. They killed Fred Hampton in his sleep after having drugged him, having had William O'Neill, agent provocateur for the FBI, who had drugged Fred Hampton's Kool-Aid to make him unable to be able to respond at all. Also provided a detailed layout of Fred Hampton's apartment to the police, you know, to make it easier for them to kill him. And like I said, they busted in the house 4 o'clock in the morning. They riddled the place full of bullets, you know. They had shot him. They pulled Fred Hampton out of the bedroom where he was sleeping. And he was still alive, and you know, witnesses say, you know, that the police said, you know, that's Fred Hampton, you know, and one of them asked, is he dead, you know, bring him out, and one of them said, he's barely alive, you know, he'll make it, and then they shot him in the head a couple times, and the other cops said, he's good and dead now. They had to get rid of Fred Hampton. And they had to kill as many leaders as they could in the Black Power movement, and crush these organizations, because of the fact that Black Power movement really challenged U.S. imperialism and really challenged the state. And I want to say a little bit of something about the state. Because, you know, we're going to be talking, as I said, and later on in the broadcast, we're going to hear discussion about, you know, the case of Jamu Bandele, who was the president of the York, Pennsylvania chapter of the International People's Democratic Uhuru Movement. And was locked up recently, a few weeks ago, by police, you know, in attempt to get him off of the streets. to keep him from being able to organize in York, to make it impossible for him to lead this struggle challenging the state there. You know, I think it's important for us to understand the state so we understand what we're looking at when we see these things. You know, when we see these cases, the cases of, like I said, Ajimu Bandele, the case of Liberty City 7, of Troy Davis, Huntsville 3, Mumi Abu-Jamal, and various others. You know, we have to understand that the state, you know, first of all, when we're talking about the police, we're talking about part of the state. We're talking about, you know, like the army that that the U.S. government sends to places like Iraq and Afghanistan to kill people in order to steal their resources. We're talking about the state. You know, the state is an organized capacity for violence. It is an organization, an apparatus. Particularly for the purpose of repression, its sole purpose is to use violence, is to use brute force to maintain a parasitic relationship. The only time in history that you see the state, and we're talking about the state, and like I said, we're talking about the police, we're talking about the army, we're talking about the court system. The only time in history where you see the state is when you have societies that are split between those who have and those who don't have. I know many people have heard this before. You heard Chairman O'Malley Eshetella talking about it. And he tells us, you know, that the state is, you know, is the thing that that, you know, keeps homeless people out of, you know, abandoned homes, that keeps people who are hungry from going and getting the food that that supermarkets would throw away, that are overflowing off the shelves. You know, the state is the thing that would prevent a sick person from going into the hospital and laying in a bed to get treated. You know, if they don't have insurance or whatever, the state is the thing that maintains the relationship between those who have and those who don't have, because those who have took everything that belongs to them. And the state, that is its purpose. You know, it is violent. You know, that's the purpose of the police. The police, regardless of what they may tell you, regardless of what is written on the side of the police car that just took your brother or your sister to prison, to jail, they are not here to protect and serve you. The purpose of the state, the purpose of the police and the various parts of the state is to maintain this relationship. And at any point in time, if the laws that are in the books don't serve the function that the state needs them to serve, they'll break the laws or they'll change the laws. And that is the way the state moves. In reality, when you look at the law, you're looking at the opinion of the ruling class. And like I said, they'll change it or they'll disregard it whenever it doesn't fit their interests. You know, so we have to understand the state. We got to understand it so that when we see the cases of forces like Ajimu Bandele, then we know what we're looking at. We know that, you know, ain't no such thing as the U.S. State locking up somebody justly. There is no such thing. There is no African, you know, the millions, the more than a million African people who are locked up in prisons in the U.S. today. Regardless of what they were charged with, their imprisonment in a U.S. government jail where they are working to build wealth for U.S. imperialism to try to save this dying economy that U.S. imperialism has. There is no such thing as that there being a just situation where you see an African locked up in prison in the U.S. There's no such thing. Because the reason why they lock up an African in prison ain't because of anything they did. It ain't because of Jumba grabbed a piece of pizza that he didn't buy. It ain't because of that. The reality is that the state locks up Africans because it has to maintain this relationship. It's because it cannot allow any kind of challenges to its capacity, challenges to the ability of U.S. imperialism to continue to steal the resources of African people and other oppressed peoples, you know. And so that's why they send, troops to various places in the world is to maintain this relationship. That's why they send troops with the name police on them into the African community all the time. It ain't to stop drug economy because the reality is that it is the U.S. government that created the illegal drug economy. And if they really wanted to stop it, they'd stop bringing stuff in. But the reality is that the reason why the police are there is to maintain its relationship, is to keep African people in lines, to keep African people from being able to get organized in our own interests. That is the purpose of the state, and we gotta understand that. That's why they killed Fred Hampton, because Fred Hampton was a problem. Fred Hampton, his organizing work presented a challenge to U.S. imperialism, to U.S. imperialism's ability to continue to steal the resources of African people, to continue to oppress and exploit African people. Fred Hampton, not as an individual, but as an organizer, as part of an organization, and that's important for us to understand. Because notwithstanding the fact that the state will beat you up and lock your ass up, as an individual, its purpose is to prevent you from being able to get organized. Its purpose is to be able is to make sure that you stay in line and that you don't have the ability to challenge the U.S. government's ability to continue to steal those resources. That's the purpose of the state. I want to open it up for those of you out there listening to participate in the discussion. We're talking about Fred Hampton, but we're not just talking about Fred Hampton, because oftentimes, people, they talk about, leaders who have been killed by our oppressors. And they talk about them in the abstract, they talk about them as, as some, person, who, some individual in history that has no relationship with what's happening now, has no relationship with the African community, and the conditions of the African community, but we can't do that. We don't have the luxury of doing that. As a people who are oppressed, as a people who as we can see, have an oppression that is deepening, ever deepening. We don't have the luxury of just celebrating individuals or celebrating, events, in the abstract. We have to look at how someone like Fred Hampton served our community and how we can follow in the footsteps of a Fred Hampton or of a Huey Newton or a Lawrence Mann. That's what we have to do. We have to examine them in the context of changing this reality that we face as oppressed peoples. I do want to, you know, as we have this discussion about Fred Hampton, I do want to play for you just some clips of some statements Fred Hampton made, you know, as the chairman of the Illinois chapter of the Black Panther Party. These are clips of statements just short clips from presentations and discussions that from Fred Hampton. So this is Fred Hampton, who was murdered on December 4th, 1969 by the U.S. government.
Fred Hampton, chairman of Illinois Panther Party.
All power to the people. What we basically going to be talking about today, we're going to be talking about political prisoners, and we're going to be talking about what the pig is doing to the Panthers all around the country. We're going to specifically be talking about what the pigs are doing to the Black Panther Party right here in Chicago, Illinois. And also, we're going to have to talk about what are we going to have to do about the repression that they're putting on the Black Panther Party in order to get that repression off of the Black Panther Party. And we're not really worried about getting off of it. Let's try to deal with it. Because you can jail a revolutionary, but you can't jail revolution. You can run a freedom fighter all around the country, but you can't run freedom fighting around the country. You can murder a liberator, but you can't murder liberation.
Right on. All power to the people.
That's the people thing. Socialism is the people.
You're afraid of yourself. If you're afraid of socialism, you're afraid of yourself.
That was Fred Hampton. That was Fred Hampton on various occasions. Fred Hampton, the chairman of the Illinois chapter of the Black Panther Party, who was murdered, assassinated by the U.S. government, the FBI, working with Chicago police on December 4th, 1969 at 4 o'clock a.m. in the morning. You know... Too often, like I said, too often, you know, we have people celebrate leaders, you know, of the past, who really, you know, these same folks who may celebrate, you know, Malcolm X or even a Marcus Garvey or you know, a Fred Hampton and other incredible forces would have no relationship with forces who are on the ground, even today, struggling to overturn the relationship that our people are held in, this parasitic relationship that the U.S. government holds our people in. And I think, you know, we have to look at the question of how do we celebrate, you know, forces like Fred Hampton? How do we celebrate forces like Malcolm X and Fannie Lou Hamer and Ella Baker and, you know, these incredible forces in history who dedicated their lives to changing the conditions, to overturning the conditions that our people find themselves in? How do we celebrate these forces? You know, in African People's Socialist Party, we say, you know, you don't celebrate these forces by just, you know, holding, celebrations and whatnot, pulling them out of the closet once a year when their birthday comes around, we don't celebrate them like that. You know, that you're not celebrating anything. If anything, you are dishonoring the memory of these people, these incredible giants. When you do that, the only way that you can celebrate a Fred Hampton, the only way that you can celebrate a Malcolm X or a Marcus Garvey, Kwame Nkrumah, Robert Mangaliso Sobukwe, the only way you can celebrate these forces is by being these forces, by being these incredible giants themselves. And it's not something that's unattainable. It's not something that you can't do. The reality is that Fred Hampton was an African who found himself at the helm of leadership in the Black Panther Party. But he found himself there because he recognized the need to change our conditions as a people. He was an African who grew up like many Africans do. You know, he was an African who witnessed, who felt the oppression just like the rest of us do. And there was nothing, different about him. He didn't come down in a spaceship into the African community. He grew up in an African community. He had an African mama, an African daddy, just like the rest of us. And the reality is that what made him significant was his choosing to dedicate his life to changing the situation that our people exist in. What made him significant was his determination to not allow African people to just be colonized, to just be oppressed and exploited. This is what made Fred Hampton significant. So if we're to celebrate Fred Hampton, if we're to celebrate any of these other incredible leaders, then we have to be them. You have to make the decisions, the decision that they made to overturn, to fight for the people, to fight for African people, to fight for a liberated African people. And of course, we understand that that meaning that we have to fight for a liberated and united Africa. you know, from the African People's Socialist Party, we recognize that, you know, that it's not good enough to just sit by and talk about these forces. It's not even good enough to even you know, say that that's who we need to be like. But what we have to do is to become these forces. What we have to do is to not just become them, because, you know, they you know, made decisions and made advances and even made errors. But we have to even learn from them and to build on what they did. We have to build on the work of Fred Hampton, build on the work of Marcus Garvey and Kwame Nkrumah and these other incredible forces. We have to build on that. Today you have, you know, an incredible leader, Omalia Shetela, you know, who is today leading an international African revolutionary organization, the African Socialist International, and we recognize that is the only way for African people to be free. That in the final analysis, that we can't be free as African Americans or as Jamaicans, Trinidadians, Nigerians, or anything like that. That what has to happen is that we have to disregard the designations, disregard the borders, the identities given to us by our oppressors, and to build a liberated and united Africa, and to do that, we got to get state power. We have to win state power. You know, you can't pray your way to a liberated united Africa. You can't dance your way to one. You can't, you know, hope ain't gonna do it. You know, and a vote ain't gonna do it. What we have to do, African people, is to get organized, to take power for ourselves, and that means challenging the state. That means fighting on these questions, defending our leaders, defending our movement, defending forces like Jamu Bendele, defending the Huntsville Three. And fighting for justice for forces like Troy Davis and Mumia Abu Jamal and the various other forces who are out there, African people who are being victimized by imperialism. We've got to overturn that relationship. We've got to win power for ourselves. This is the way forward for us African people. You know, this is how, like I said, this is how we celebrate Fred Hampton and these other forces, is by carrying on that work and winning, you know, bringing this thing to completion. You know, Fred Hampton ain't here to finish the fight. But you are, we are. And we have to carry on the fight. We have to win. You know, that's it for Africa Live here on ahuradio.com. But it's okay. You know, I know you're gonna miss it. I'm gonna miss it too. But it's coming back next week. And even though it's the end for us today, it's not the end for Ahura Radio altogether. Because next up, you've got Uhura on the Move with Impidum President Ivory Sobukwe-Sodaye and Kobina Bantu Shango, who are going to be talking about the case of Jamu Bendele, the York, Pennsylvania branch president of the International People's Democratic Uhura Movement, who is locked up right now in York, Pennsylvania. They're going to be talking about Mumia Abu Jamal, who is another political prisoner who has been locked up for many years, you know, and who the state, these two forces who the state of is trying to get rid of, trying to take away from our community, to keep away from our community because they don't want you to be like them. So stay tuned because they're going to talk about more on Uhuru on the Move next up on UhuruRadio.com. I want to leave you with Izwe Letu e Africa. Africa is our land. Touch one, touch all. Forward to the final offensive. Uhuru.
Africa Live.
Saying is, ain't nobody gonna do this for us but us. Talk about a Barack Obama. Don't even talk to me about Barack Obama. Let's talk about Marcus Garvey. You know what I'm saying? The question ain't whether we vote for white power and white face or white power and black face. The question is whether we will be an independent people or whether we remain colonized and oppressed until we are wiped out. This is African internationalism in action, y'all. Y'all need to get up on this. When we say we have to have power in our own hands, here, we're talking about the African working class. What we can do is to have an organized capacity of the African workers in alliance with the poor peasants who takes state power for itself. Then we can begin to say we got justice in our own hands.
Africa Live.
Raise up these incredible African leaders that we've had. It's critical that as African people we strive to be like them. I'm talking about the Marcus Garveys. I'm talking about the Fannie Lou Hamers. I'm talking about the Malcolm X's, the Kwame Nkrumahs, and today we have Omali Eshitella.
Brothers and sisters, Africans at home and abroad, welcome to Africa Live.
My people got no time to wait, so said it's time for action. Who rules on the move? We gotta make this happen. The beast is in the streets, ain't nothing sweet, they clapping. Our children in the school system under attack. People, we got no time to wait, so said it's time for action.